Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Itai Itzan, whose book is Awareness is Freedom, The Adventure of Psychology and Spirituality. We are speaking with him from England. He is a professor at the University of East London, a psychologist, and a seeker of spiritual enlightenment, like most of the guests on my show. And he's written a very interesting book called Awareness is Freedom. It's actually a program to help one, with exercises and entire program for, having the, let me just have you, have you describe the program and what it can do for the listeners. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you, Susan. Well, very briefly, I'll just say that the idea behind the program that I've created is to bring together psychology and spirituality. I think those are two disciplines that are frequently seen as disconnected. So, especially right. within the scientific framework where I study and teach and research and write. Those two seem to be very separate, but I found out of my personal experience, within my personal journey of psycho-spiritual growth, I found that they are immensely important for one another. So my psychological journey enhances my spiritual one, and my spiritual one enhances my psychological one, so that I grow when both of them are alive within me. So that's very briefly.
So your experiences as a educator in psychology.
I wasn't actually referring to my experiences as an educator in psychology. No, I was referring to my experiences of life in general. Also, obviously, as an educator in psychology, but also as a spiritual seeker, as a parent, as a friend, as a family member, as a human being. That's the kind of experiences I'm referring to when I said that those two, when they come together, psychology and spirituality, they allow me growth as every aspect of me being human.
Well, psychology often is the science of the mind. It's our thoughts, our feelings, how those go together. Now, I think you've made I think you've made the connection between the thoughts and the emotions, and then you've made the additional connection between the emotions and having the physical or symptomatic things within the body occur because of the flow of that information. And that's what I found very interesting about your book, is that you've been able to bring it back down into what I do, which is medicine. You know, when people come in with symptoms of headaches and all of these other somatic problems, we also, look for physical illness, but then much of illness comes from problems with the thoughts and subsequent problems with the emotions.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, perhaps I'll first say a few words about that relationship between psychology and spirituality, and then I can go into that link between the thoughts and emotions and the body. So for me, as you said, and that's very accurate. I mean, the whole world of psychology is about our mind, and I think if we go deeper than that, psychology is about the building blocks of ourself. So if I think about my own personal self as this kind of a structure that I've created, what psychology allows me to do is to better understand the building blocks that create that structure, the bits and pieces that come together in the creation of Itai or anyone else. So that's the psychological structure. And then spirituality spirituality is a very different experience. Spirituality for me, and obviously, I mean, spirituality is a very personal experience, and different people define it in different ways, and they experience it in different ways. But at least from a scientific point of view, that the literature refers to spirituality as the idea of self-transcendence, which is those moments when we can let go of a self, of the idea of a self, or from a spiritual point of view, we can let go of the illusion of a self, and we transcend that. So that we then, under those circumstances, in that state of consciousness, we come in touch with the world without the backpack of a personal self. And that creates a very different experience of life. It creates an experience where we can very easily connect to everything and everyone. We can see beyond the distortions of the ego and the personality. We can see clear. We can relate with greater and deeper compassion. We can feel incredible things, because whatever we feel is independent of our personal self, which is very interesting, because from a psychological point of view, when we feel stuff, it's because something happened according to my reaction. So if I feel happy, it's because he or she said something nice to me. If I feel sad or in pain, it's because something happened against what I wanted and needed. If I feel peaceful, it's because certain circumstances fell into place, and that makes me feel more at peace. But from a spiritual point of view, all of those experiences, happiness, peace, love, they are independent of anything and everything. So we don't need anything to happen, because that's our natural state of consciousness, which we can only feel when we self-transcend, when we move beyond those basic building blocks of a self where there's deep attachment to certain things. Okay, so that's a very kind of brief definition of psychology and spirituality. That I need to start with, because everything else kind of continues and flows and builds up from that definition. Because if we then continue into what you've mentioned, which is very important, the relationship between thoughts and emotions and the body, I feel that's a very, very important relationship for us. Because if we want to move into the beauty of spirituality, in this incredible transformation that is the gift of self-transcendence, then we have to let go of those building blocks. We need to move beyond those building blocks. And the most important message in my book, Awareness is Freedom, The Adventure of Psychology and Spirituality, is that we cannot transcend that which we don't know. I'll say it again, because this for me is the heart and soul of everything that I teach. We cannot transcend that which we don't know. So that's why, you know thyself, back in ancient times, was such a basic understanding within human growth and transformation. Because how can we move beyond something we're not even aware of? And a lot of us were carrying a lot of building blocks within ourselves that we do not acknowledge, that we push away, that we are blind to, that we don't really work with, that we try to escape because we feel uncomfortable with it. And for me, part of the psycho-spiritual journey is reconnecting with every bit of the self so that we can acknowledge it, embrace it, and then let go of it. Paradoxically, we can move beyond something when we accept it, when we embrace it. As long as we reject it and push it away, we might not see it on a conscious level, but it sits deep within us, bubbling like a lava under the deeper layers of the self, and it will keep on influencing us and keep on triggering reactions. And as part of the spiritual journey, we reconnect with everything that is sitting within us. Some of it is very nice to engage with, very, very nice feelings and sensations, and some of it is very uncomfortable, but all of it is very important. Now, why is that important? Because when we talk about engaging with our thoughts, engaging with our emotions, and engaging with bodily sensations, what we need to understand is that they're all the same. So they are different expressions of the same thing. And this is something that we now show very, very clearly within psychological research that our thought patterns are related to our emotional responses, which are related to sensations in the body. In other words, when I feel tightness in my chest, it is part of a certain emotion, say fear, which is then linked to certain thought patterns, say, oh my God, tomorrow I'm going to meet him or her, and I don't know what's going to happen, and that uncertainty makes me feel anxiety. So they're always linked together, which means that being aware of one is being aware of all. So that transcendence that I talked about could happen on those different levels. It's just that out of my experience and out of the experience of many, many people who work in this field, the easiest form to relate to, the easiest level to work with and connect with is the bodily levels, the bodily sensations. Those are the easiest to feel, and when we learn the art of listening to our body, and it is an art that requires time and patience. Personally, I do that with meditation, but you know, we can relate and connect with our body in different ways. When we are become knowledgeable and experienced with that art, that's a wonderful and powerful invitation to move beyond those building blocks that I talked about earlier. One final point I want to make is that the fascinating thing here is that all of those patterns, the thought patterns, the emotional patterns, they move within us, and at the beginning of their linkage with the body, there's a whisper. So at the beginning, it might be something very subtle. It might be a very subtle sensation that we feel somewhere, a certain emotion or a certain sensation in the body. And if we hear it, and we breathe into it, and we connect with it, and we find ways to work with it and acknowledge it and embrace it, as I said earlier, then we can let it move away and disappear, dissipate. However, what most of us do is push it away. And when we push it away, it grows. And then from a gentle whisper, it will start talking to us more loudly and more loudly, and it will shout. And if we keep on not hearing it, it will scream, and the screaming then leads to the breaking, going back to the point you were making about illness. That's where psychology meets the body. And when an illness kicks in, when there is some psychological distress or some psychological difficulty, something is moving within us on a cognitive thought level, emotional level, and then within the body, we do not work with it. And then if we don't let it out, it explodes.
And one thing in your book I found interesting was the experiment that was done where two different groups were given words, and the group that was given the words that indicated that were associated with old age were then observed to walk much more slowly, which illustrates the point that this stuff is subconscious.
Absolutely.
Because they weren't aware that they were walking slowly. You want to expand on that a little bit? Because I was totally unaware that that occurred at a subconscious level.
Oh, absolutely. It's a very powerful process, and by now it's well documented. We call it in psychology priming, and priming means that whatever we digest, whatever we see, whatever we observe is having an unconscious impact. And it makes us behave in certain ways according to what we see and what we, for example, if people are similar studies to what you've just described. Yeah, people, we have two groups, and one group will read something around money and the importance of money. And the other group will read something around generosity and the importance of generosity. And then they will, on their way out, they will encounter a beggar, obviously, a participant, not a participant, but someone who's working with the researcher as part of the study. Those who read about the importance of money and having more money will significantly offer the beggar less money compared to those who read about generosity. Now, here the linkage is kind of more direct than in the example of those who read words linked with old age. But in both cases, if you would have asked the people involved, they wouldn't necessarily be able to say that, hey, it's because I read X that made me behave the way that I do. But that's the case. Which frequently, when I teach this whole topic in class, what I tell people is, be very careful about what you take in. The books that you read, the stuff you see on TV, the stuff you read on the internet. Because whether you're aware of it or not, it is shaping your psyche. It is shaping your cognitive processing, and then it shapes your behavior. So bringing more awareness to those choices we make is very important to our psychological health.
So in studies similar to this, when children primarily watch violent TV shows or cartoons or participate in games that are violent, does that translate into more violent behavior for the children?
Well, there's a lot of research around this, and it isn't as clear cut as you know. I can't make a very clear statement here, but without a doubt, the more children are exposed to aggressive, violent TV shows, the more it has an impact on their aggressive behaviors. So I'm not trying to condemn TV series as kind of a black and white thing, as in this is very bad. So there are some TV shows which are very, very good for children. Especially what research shows that is very important is whether or not the parent is watching with the child. So this is one very important. Yeah, so if a parent is sitting with a child and explaining that this happened because of this happened because of that, so that, that the child doesn't get kind of a distorted understanding of reality out of the TV show, that's a very important variable influencing the child behavior.
Interesting. So you personally went on a spiritual journey yourself and discovered the benefits of meditation. And in your book, you give a lot of exercises. And one of the interesting things in one of the chapters later on is all of the different meditation techniques. Would you like to talk a little bit about that, the importance of meditation in this process, and how there's just not one type of meditation that people can do?
Yeah. Well, first of all, a few words about meditation. I mean, meditation is very interesting as a concept. When I started this area maybe 15 years ago, people told me, you know, this is all very interesting, but maybe you should find a different research area, maybe a different area to teach, because this isn't really psychology and this isn't kind of hardcore science. But since then, so much has changed, and today mindfulness meditation is one of the most researched psychological interventions in psychology, and it's being used frequently by doctors and health psychologists and nurses and educators in schools. So it became very, very popular. Now, the reason that it became so popular is that the scientific studies show without a shred of a doubt that it's highly beneficial to us. So people who meditate regularly find great benefits. They are more peaceful. They have reduced levels of anxiety, stress, and depression. They feel happier. They feel more hopeful. They feel more grateful. So wonderful, wonderful benefits. And obviously, I'm talking about regular practice, daily practice of, say, minimum of 10 to 15 minutes. And when I say meditation, just to clarify what is it that I'm talking about, meditation is a very simple experience. It's simply being in the moment, in the activity of whatever you're doing in the moment, and letting go of any interpretation or judgment or reaction to the activity. Now, it sounds very simple, but in reality, it's not as simple as that, because our mind is conditioned to react. And it goes back to those building blocks that I talked about earlier. because we have those personal understandings of life and what's right and what's wrong and what's good and what's bad, then whenever we encounter something, whenever we come in touch with something, then our mind immediately wanders, and it wanders into judgment, thoughts about what is this and how could this be better or worse for me and so on and so forth. So we react to the moment instead of being with whatever is happening. And what we now see in research is that when people allow themselves to be present, which means let go of what we call mind wandering, they enjoy life much more. So I'll give you a very simple example, which then links to the whole question of meditation techniques. If you take a number of studies were showing that if you take a large group of people and you ask them to wash the dishes, but you randomly allocate them to two different groups. The first group is a group of mind wandering, where they are being asked to think about other things, other activities, stuff they had with their boss, friends, and so on and so forth. While the second group is being asked to be very, very present. Now, what does being present mean when you wash the dishes? It means feeling the temperature of the water and feeling the texture of the plate and feeling everything that you actually, if any sensation that you experience as part of washing dishes, you are just being present with that and focus on those. And they've measured a variety of both physiological and psychological variables for both of these groups, and what they found was that those people who were present, those people who were with the washing of the dishes instead of thinking about other things, they enjoyed it much more, they had an increase in their positive emotions, and they had a decrease in their negative emotions. So all in all, it was a much more pleasant experience for them. And we've got a lot of studies now showing pretty much the same thing. When our mind is wandering, we do not get as much benefit out of the activity compared to when our mind is present with the experience, whatever that is. Now, that's very interesting because, and now I go back to the question you've asked about meditation techniques, because when I say the word meditation in class, when I teach meditation, and I teach meditation and I also teach meditation teacher training, so I teach a lot of I train a lot of people how to teach meditation, which I think is very important these days because there's so much interest in meditation. We need to have well-qualified meditation teachers. When I say meditation in class for the first time, what almost everyone think of as the first image is this monk sitting at the top of a mountain, right, like a lotus kind of position, folded legs, straight back, very rigid, kind of eyes closed, sitting there for weeks and weeks, breathing, and that's the image we have when we think of meditation. But in reality, we can let go of that image, although that's sitting, breathing meditation is a wonderful technique, and a lot of people enjoy it, and it's a great way to meditate. But we can meditate in many, many different ways. There are many other formal meditation techniques, such as walking meditation, and even we've got smiling meditation, and body scan meditation, and mantra meditation, and intention meditation. So there are a lot of other formal meditations. But I would say, more importantly, any moment in life could be meditative as long as we are present. Going back to the example I gave with washing the dishes, which is perhaps the most kind of mundane, simple, everyday life experience, that we can switch from being a task into a meditative experience. So, and that's also very important for people who say, you know, I don't have time to meditate. Well, you know, if we bring that attitude of I'm present and I'm not letting my mind wander, I'm being very connected to the sensations and the experience of the present moment and nowhere else, and we bring that into the shower, into the experience of walking outside or walking with a dog, into washing dishes and so on and so forth, into running. Running is such a wonderful invitation for meditation. But what most of us do when we run is we think about other things. If instead we would have been very connected to the movement of the muscles and the breath and the sweat that is trickling, we would have been meditating. So basically the point I'm trying to make is that any moment in life could be meditation if we bring in the right state of consciousness.
Now, your next chapter, or lesson 3, is aware unaware versus aware thinking. So this this is a similar type of idea, but in terms of when we're actually thinking, how do you differentiate between the aware and the unaware thinking?
Well, the main point I'm trying to make in that chapter is around the whole question of what is thinking and how do we relate to thinking within the spiritual journey. I'm saying that because frequently for people who are deeply spiritual, the idea of thinking and psychology, that seems to be kind of outside the framework of being spiritual. While I personally think that thinking and cognition, they are wonderful aspects of being human. I need my mind, so there are a lot of questions around the mind. Like, what is the role of the mind within the psycho-spiritual journey, right? Again, from a spiritual point of view, the mind is something that we need to let go of. But I personally feel that as a human being, the mind is a wonderful tool. And I need, in order for us to have this interview, for example, this conversation, then I had to check my diary and compare options and think about whether or not this is right for me and so on and so forth. I had to use the mind in order to make decisions. The mind is a wonderful tool when we use it in a healthy way, and going back to aware and unaware thinking. As long as, for example, when we've been discussing this option of having this conversation, I'm looking at my diary, I'm making a decision, this is aware thinking, I'm making a choice, and then I can let go of it, right, and move into a state of meditation or a state of openness until the next moment when I need to think again.
Mm-hmm.
However, what happens for most of us is that we are so addicted to thinking, so thinking is such an automatic conditioned state that we can't let go of it. So
right.
once I've made the decision to have this conversation with you and wrote in my diary, instead of letting go of it, I go into thinking mode and start thinking, oh, so what should I talk about, and how would
right.
it be? Was it the right choice? Wasn't the right choice? So, and obviously we can apply it to anything, to a meeting we're going to have tomorrow, to a conversation we've had with a friend. So we're it's as if we carry in our backpack of the mind a lot of stuff that shouldn't be there.
Right. Yeah. Going, second guessing ourselves.
What's that? So as part of that, we're second guessing ourselves.
Mm.
Basically, we're driving ourselves crazy, and this is something that a lot of people can very easily kind of empathize with. And that's one of the important roles of meditation, because it allows you an alternative way of being, so that you can. I usually think about this as breathing. Okay, so we breathe in and out, right? We inhale and we exhale, and there has to be a balance there. And the same applies to thinking and being, or doing and being, right? This is a really important question, the whole balance of doing and being. When I say doing, I mean anything we think about, any activity. And when I say being, I'm talking about letting go of everything and just breathing, just being present. Mm-hmm. And when there is a balance between these two, there's this wonderful feeling of as if it's this inhale and exhale, and there's in and out, and it feels balanced and it feels healthy. But for most of us, there's very little being. We are so into the doing that we get lost in the doing. And when we get lost in the doing, this is when levels of stress increase, and levels of anxiety increase, and level of discomfort increase, and as you said, self-doubt increases, and second-guessing increases. So we feel very uncomfortable because it's overwhelming. Yeah, in psychology we call it cognitive and emotional overload. And that's one of the wonderful gifts of meditation, that it allows us a way out. It allows us to take a step back, breathe, relax, move back into this centered, peaceful space within, and then move back into the doing and into the activity. And that's a healthy balance that I think when we adopt it, we get a wonderful gift for life.
Yeah, going back to your example of like deciding whether or not to do an interview, if you're in the meditative state and connected with your higher guidance, then you'll get the correct information. If it's going to be uplifting and good for you and good for the audience. And no, if, say, I was one of these interviewers that would try to criticize you or somehow, you know, disrupt the conversation constantly, you know, kind of the some of the TV shows have that kind of I know Larry Dossey one time told me that he had that experience on TV with a fairly well-known person who's not very spiritual. You know, he went on thinking that he was going to talk about the concepts in his book, and instead they made fun of him, you know. So, and then versus going back to past experience. So Larry, having got a second interview offer from TV, might go to that experience and say no, which would obviously be the wrong thing to do. Or he would go into meditative state and get a yes or no based on whether or not it was going to be a positive experience. So
that's a beautiful description. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think the point you're making is very important. Letting go of past experience as our guide for the future.
Right.
And learning to work on a different level. Absolutely.
So really the meditative experience, which we do need to do on a daily basis, and on a continuous basis, like you say, I love the idea of the walking meditation, the meditation while doing dishes, the mindfulness experiments where you try to stay mindful at all times in the present. This allows us to maintain this connection with this higher guidance. Whereas if we break that up, we go into the overload that you spoke of earlier. And that overload can get to any of us. I mean, it is very, very possible, especially when you're physically ill. I deal with a lot of women who are physically ill from contaminated or defective breast implants, and they can't meditate. You know, they try to meditate, they just can't. So when you're in a dealing with a physical illness, oftentimes, especially a toxic illness, you can't get to these higher levels of meditation and peace. And so it's a constant downhill spiral.
Yes, I completely understand why physical pain in general is a huge challenge for the state of meditation. But I do want to say, and this would be, I think, very interesting for the listeners, that mindfulness meditation has been found to be one of the most effective psychological interventions for pain.
Yeah.
And I want to explain why is that the case. It's interesting to think about why is that the case. When we experience pain, there are two layers of pain, two dimensions to the pain. The first is what we call primary pain. Primary pain is the physiological reaction in the body. So imagine, for example, that I wake up in the middle of the night and I am thirsty. I want to have a glass of water, and I don't have water in the next to my bed, so I get up in the darkness and I walk to the kitchen, and on my way to the kitchen I stab my toe at the edge of my bed, which is something that some of us experience at least once or twice in their life.
Right.
And that's obviously very painful, and that's that the moment that I stab my toe, that's the primary pain, when signals are being sent from my toe into my brain saying pain, and that's painful. And that's primary pain, and there's nothing we can do about primary pain. However, then comes what we call in psychology secondary pain, and that's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Secondary pain is our reaction to the primary pain.
Mm-hmm.
In the example that I gave, for example, is that moment when I stub my toe at the edge of the bed, I might start thinking, oh, I'm so stupid, I should have left the bed. Why is it so dark? And why is my kitchen so, and why am I so clumsy? And obviously those are the thoughts, and that's the anger, and my body will be tensing in reaction to those thoughts, right? Going back to what we said earlier about the relationship between mind and emotions and body, they all come together. And that would have a huge impact on the level of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the bottom line here, which I find mind-blowing. What we see in psychology, in scientific studies, is that frequently secondary pain, the reactions to the original pain, is worse than the primary pain, which I think is quite amazing. So the way that we react to the original pain is making the pain much worse compared to the original pain that we had. Mm-hmm. Now, why then is meditation so important? Because if we remember what we said earlier, is that meditation is the skill of being able to be present with whatever we experience without reacting to it, right? And we start by practicing, for example, with our breath, or with the experience of walking and the sensations of walking, but we can then do the same with other experiences, such as pain. So when people who suffer from chronic pain study how to meditate, learn how to meditate, and then they meditate regularly, they report that they have a much less of a reactive attitude towards that primary pain that I talked about, and therefore the levels of pain are significantly reduced. So that's why, although pain is without a doubt a huge challenge to life in general, not just to meditation, but to life in general, meditation is a very good way to help us and make it a little bit better.
And one of the interesting things that occurs with some physical pain is that the cause of the pain may not be physical. I mean, if you've got a disc problem from a, you know, say a malabsorption problem where you don't absorb protein properly and your disc start to degenerate and the degenerated disc caused the bulging on the nerve root, well, that's physical pain. But what's interesting to me is the psychological or emotional pain where Carolyn Mace says you carry your wallet in your lower back. So when you start having financial troubles, you develop low back pain. And there is no physical cause of the pain, but the pain feels just the same as if the disc were causing the pain.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to what we said earlier about the fact that, that our psyche and our psychological processes and our thoughts, for example, they are very strongly linked with everybody. So, you know, the way I think about it is that we are one entity. So the soul and the body and the psyche, the cognitive, they all come together. And when there's movement in one, there's movement in all. And that's something we need to understand. And going back to the point you're making, absolutely. So certain psychological challenges would obviously then have an impact on the body.
So much of humanity is not aware. It goes back to the title of your book, Awareness is Freedom. They're not aware of these different aspects of self. One of your chapters is on self and the awareness of self. Can you go through the different levels of awareness of self, who we are, and then finally when we transcend the idea of the lower aspects of self, how that leads to freedom?
Yes, absolutely. So in my book, I talk about the self as the lowercase s self and the capital S self. And the lowercase s self is that psychological experience of the self that I talked about at the beginning, the relationship with life out of a self that is filled with ideas about what's right and what's wrong, which are obviously our ego concepts. So throughout life, you talked about our past experience and how important it is not to let our past experience dictate our future choices. But in reality, that's what most of us do most of the time, because past experiences shape what I call ego concepts. Ego concepts are ideas we accumulate about ourselves and about life, and those ideas are sitting within us. And as long as we allow those ideas, those ego concepts, to dictate our choices and our life and our relationships, we are trapped within that lowercase s self. And I really want to emphasize that it's very human to experience that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I do think that it's narrowing our lives. I do think that we can move beyond that and experience something deeper that I'm going to talk about in a minute. But before I even go there, I really want to emphasize that I feel that we came here as human beings because we needed to engage with that lowercase s self, with that narrowed experience of the self, so that we could confront it, work with it, digest it, process it, and perhaps let go of certain aspects of it. And when we do let go of certain aspects of it, we get a glimpse of the capital S self, that expanded self, what is frequently referred to as the state of enlightenment or expanded consciousness or pure consciousness or open consciousness. But the idea behind all of these different labels is very simple. It's the experience of life when all of these ego concepts that we carry disappear. And I personally, for me, the way I like describing it is I think about this as an undercurrent river that is running within all of us. And the beauty of this river is it's the same river. It's precisely the same river. And when we jump into the water of that internal river, we feel that happiness and peace and deep, deep, incredibly deep love that I talked about, those are independent of our external circumstances. So, as I said earlier, those are not the kind of emotions and feelings we feel because something happened. It's this kind of stuff we feel because we transcend our personal self, our narrow self, mm-hmm. and we feel that incredible connection to everything. That, for me, is self-transcendence. And I feel that we are all being invited into that river. However, the river is covered. The water of the river is covered with those ego concepts. Think about them as layers that are covering and covering and covering. And sometimes we pierce through those layers and we get a glimpse of the water. We might even get an actual swim in the water. Those are moments when we are in deep meditation. Those are moments when we have this moments of great connection with nature, for example. That's another wonderful invitation to let go of the ego concepts. We walk up a mountain and the sun is setting or the sun is rising in the sky, and we suddenly feel as if everything that defines us disappears, and all I remain with is this incredible connection with everything around me. That, for me, is the beauty of spirituality, of the beauty of spiritual transcendence, and that's the capital S self, that connection with everything. And for me, the whole psycho-spiritual journey is befriending that internal river so that we have a bridge created as part of our psycho-spiritual work so that when we need, we are able to consciously choose to dive into that river, which is a wonderful, wonderful gift we could give ourselves, right? And here comes a very interesting question that, you know, different people think about it in different ways, but I don't believe we are supposed to swim in that river 24/7 every day in our lives. So I don't believe in the idea of permanent enlightenment. Okay, some people talk about enlightenment as something that could be permanent, something that we could just move into, and then we're constantly there. I've met many, many spiritual teachers, and I've spoken to some of them, are very good friends of mine. I've never seen a human being who is constantly in that state of transcendence. So personally, and that's my understanding of it, I don't think this is what we're supposed to experience. However, a glimpse into it and a connection with it and a bridge into it is a reminder. It's a reminder of the soul. It's a reminder of transcendence. It's a reminder that we are much, much more than our psyche and our body. And that connection with the greater nature and universe, it's a wonderful internal reminder because I feel that it brings balance. It brings balance and it gives us an invitation into that beautiful swimming experience of love, compassion, and peace that is available for us whenever we need it.
I agree. I think that that's well spoken. So we are coming up on the end of our hour here. Would you like to give your contact information?
Well, I'd love to give my website, which is awarenessisfreedom.com. As simple as that. awarenessisfreedom.com. So visit my website and you can find my workshops and my books, my teachings, and I've got free guided meditations, a lot of very interesting stuff, which is obviously very deeply linked with the journey that I've been talking about today.
So before we end, I'd like to talk a little bit about the lessons in Chapter 7, which I think is important for almost anybody in crisis, and also anybody who's had a significant grief experience. And that's that everything is impermanent. In other words, things are constantly changing. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, this is one of the one of the things that are most difficult for us as human beings to accept. The simple truth that everything is impermanent. And if we look at it objectively, if we discuss it on an objective level, everyone would agree, because that's the truth of life. Everything truly changes. The weather changes, people change. Those whom you want to stay precisely as they are, they will become different. They will shapeshift and change. People you want in your life will go away. People you don't want in your life will appear in your life, and everything is within that flux and movement. So on an objective level, as a discussion, everyone agrees with that. But then when it comes to our own personal lives, it's a very, very difficult thing to accept. And here for me, and this is my personal relationship with it. The important question is, how much do we trust life? If we are in a state of trust, in a deep state of real trust, then whatever appears in our lives, we know, and I really mean the word know. I don't think it's right. I know deep within me that it's right for me. It might be very uncomfortable. It might be painful. It might be difficult, but it's right for me. And when I have that level of trust, then there is no resistance, right? There's no resistance with the impermanence, with the movement, with the different experiences. And that allows a great relief. Again, I'm not saying it's easy or fun or joyful all the time. Frequently it is an engagement with stuff that is uncomfortable. But when we allow that to happen, there's a real deep relaxation within.
And you can get more information about why things have happened, too. And sometimes it's not what you think. It's not always to make your life uncomfortable. A lot of times it's the other person's lesson that you're going to participate in. And it's not really going to affect your life as much as you think it might. That's what I hear a lot of times. This person was brought in because they need this lesson and you're going to be able to give it to them.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
For something that I'm thinking is going to disrupt my life, and the answer is no, it really isn't. You'll have some things that you'll have to do, but then it's not going to be as bad as you think it might be.
Absolutely. And
getting more information is important, because you can't just go by past experience like we talked about before. Sometimes this thing happens again, it's actually easier for you because you've been through it before.
True. Very true. Yeah.
So I think that what you said was absolutely beautiful, that if we remain in a deep state of trust, then everything that comes into our field is for our own spiritual growth, or for the other person sometimes. But if you've agreed to do the dance,
exactly. And I want to add to that. I mean, you're from what you're saying, it's as if it is for the other person's lesson or the other person's experience. But because I believe that nothing is coincidental, and there is some kind of a meaningful action within whatever we go through, then even if I participate in someone else's lesson, which I agree with you is something that happens, it's because I need that role in their lesson for my personal growth. Because everything is in perfect harmony, then that's the role I needed to take for my own growth.
It's true. That's very, very true. But you can't, what I'm saying is you can't just go on past experience. Sometimes the second or third time you go through something is much easier.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's probably why you volunteered to do it, because it really is not going to be as painful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we are coming up on the end of our hour. Is there any words of inspiration or anything you'd like to tell our listening audience?
Well, the only thing I'd like to share is that, and that is my personal experience, which is that this psycho-spiritual journey that I've talked about, the psycho-spiritual journey that is part of my book, The Awareness of Freedom, The Adventure of Psychology and Spirituality, it's deeply rewarding. And when I think about different choices in my life and you know, different paths I have walked and I could have walked and different choices I've made, I realize that the psycho-spiritual journey that I've chosen to be part of is not always easy and not always fun, but it's so deeply rewarding. And if I look at my life and I'm thinking, what would I have been if I wouldn't have walked that path of the psycho-spiritual journey? I feel grateful towards my old self for making the choices he had made that brought me here. So what I would like to invite everyone to do is to move deeper into that psycho-spiritual journey, because there are so many revelations that are waiting deep within you to be explored, insights that are based on that self-awareness we've been talking about. So go ahead and do it. It's a great, great gift that is waiting at the end of this path.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed your book. I think that it is a great program for people who are wanting to get more out of life and especially become more aware of how their thoughts and emotions do impact the physical. And also they probably impact what comes next, you know, in terms of if we've got a lesson to learn, then things keep coming. And until we get the lesson, and that goes back to the trust aspect, that we're really here to make these breakthroughs. But awareness of like we said before, the unconscious aspect of what we are what we have around us, the unconscious aspect of on our behavior, and all of these things need to come into conscious awareness so that we can shift them. And meditation, yoga, and some of the exercises in your book are excellent ways to help this awareness come forth.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please check out Awareness is Freedom, The Adventure of Psychology and Spirituality, and join us next week.
Thank you, Susan.